Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 126 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Busy Art Betke Makes Soft White Wheat His Business, about my conversation with the cereal scientist and Moscow, Idaho city councilman. Although our paths crossed before, I really got to know Betke about 10 years ago, just after he retired from 31 years at the Western Wheat Quality Lab in Pullman. Since then, I've done at least a half dozen stories in Wheat Life magazine that have featured research he's conducted at the behest of the Washington Grain Commission, which we'll get into ahead. I've also seen him operate in an overseas context when he presented before Japanese, Korean, and Taiwanese millers and bakers at the second North Asian Marketing Conference held in Hawaii. Betke specializes in research into the biochemical and genetic constituents of wheat and how those constituents relate to end-use functionality. In other words, he's a chemist, but his chemicals are the array of essential elements found in a kernel of wheat. Betke opened his consulting firm after he retired in 2011 and has been in almost constant demand since then, traveling to 17 different countries, either for U.S. Wheat Associates, the U.S. government, the WGC, or private companies. I think he's popular because he tells people the science behind their practices. Not only does he vindicate what they're doing scientifically, he provides them the tools to tweak their efforts further. Here's a big for instance. Back in the late 1990s or early 2000s, a team of WGC commissioners traveled to Chile, where they observed soft white wheat being blended into hard red wheat. The Chileans told the team the blending resulted in a loaf of bread of equal quality to the non-blended loaf at a cheaper price. They had no idea why it worked. It just did. After trying to sell the concept without an understanding of why it worked, the WGC hired Betke to explain what was happening, biochemically speaking. He came up with what is known as the sweet spot study, which explained why adding up to 40% soft white wheat flour with hard red wheat flours resulted in products of equal or better quality. From there, a technician was hired to push the concept in Latin America. Mills were visited, explanations ensued, and while there have been some successes, old habits die hard, both for the mills and bakeries, but also for exporters. Efforts continue. Betke is not an imposing man. He's smaller than me, and I don't consider myself imposing. I bring the subject up because of a story about Betke I love to tell. He was in Minneapolis for a meeting of the American Association of Cereal Chemists, standing on the platform of a light rail line waiting for the train to take him back to his hotel, when a young man grabbed the purse of the woman standing next to him. She hung onto the purse and yelled. The others on the platform did nothing. Betke came to the woman's aid and appeared to succeed in his efforts, when he was cold-cocked from behind by an accomplice of the thief. Despite the less-than-stellar outcome, I have great respect for what Betke did and can only hope in a similar circumstance I would do the same. Although I usually know where I'm starting from when I do a podcast, something Betke said as I was setting up my equipment on the dining room table in his beautiful Moscow, Idaho home grabbed my attention. He said he had been invited to Afghanistan by the agency USAID for International Development to advise on what was needed to set up a wheat quality lab in the country. Can you blame me? I wanted to know more. If it was a rabbit hole, it turned out to be one worth going down.
Yeah, USAID would like to get Afghanistan weaned a little further away from the opium crop and also assist in providing the growers there with a market for the wheat, not only for their benefit, but for the benefit of the consumers as well. So they wanted to set up a wheat quality lab in Kabul, Afghanistan. And I politely declined a trip to do a site visit myself, not being enamored of going into Kabul at this time in history. Be fun to go, but not now. So anyway, after finding out how much a Hui Quality Lab cost to set up, they pulled back on their plans to set up the Hui Lab there and are trying to instead work through CIMMYT and ICARTA, two big genetic grain consortium, and get their wheat from there.
And now you had a sample of Afghan wheat that came to you. Now, you know, I'm going to get into some questions about quality, but just tell me, what was the quality of that Afghan wheat?
Well, if there's a word that means something worse than abysmal, that would be the word. It is awful. It apparently grows well in the Afghan climate, which is what CIMMYT and ICARTA specialize in, is the dissemination of quality germplasm for agronomic traits. But when it comes to end use, it's terrible, and the Afghan consumers don't want anything to do with Afghan wheat. They bring in wheat from Pakistan instead and use that, and that is not a great compliment to Pakistani wheat necessarily. It's just the fact that it's marginally better than the Afghan wheat. So they have real quality issues. The wheat grows, you can harvest it, but it's rejected by the consumers, the millers, and the bakers in favor of wheat that they've imported by truck at great cost across the Khyber Pass from Pakistan. It's a terrible situation.
What makes poor quality wheat?
Depends on who you ask. If you're a farmer, poor quality wheat is wheat that has problems with disease resistance, doesn't grow well in the field, maybe is too late, and can't be harvested before the fall rains come. To the farmers, wheat is a grain that grows well in the field, produces a lot of bushels per acre because that's what a farmer gets paid for. If you're an intermediate person moving the grain, exporting it, selling it, quality would be good plump kernels, high test weights, free of dockage contaminants, fungal toxins, things like that. That would be high quality wheat at that point. It gets to a mill, it had better be producing a lot of pounds of flour per bushel of wheat when you put it onto the mill. It should mill easily. The bran should separate cleanly from the endosperm that makes the flour, and you should get a lot of it. But to the bakers and the consumers, it had better be something that actually produces a product that people want to eat. Bread should have a lot of water absorption. It should produce a nice large loaf. It should make people want to buy it. It should have nice aroma, good texture to it. If you're making a cake or a cookie, you're looking for other attributes. You're looking for something that's tender, not chewy, not hard on your mouth when you eat it. You don't want a cake that is chewy. You want a cake that is delicate and melts in your mouth more or less. So each one of these different entity has a competing vision of what quality is. And in the end, it's the consumer who's paying for it, and you have to listen to what the consumers say that is quality. And this gets into the whole problem of wheat quality assessment. How do you quantitate a quality, which is just a human opinion about a particular product? How do you put a number on that? And then things get pretty hairy when you get into the quality evaluation of grain.
But in case of the Afghan grain, and I don't want to get too tied into this because it is Afghanistan, but in terms of the Afghan grain, I mean, it just won't make a product.
No, it has absolutely no gluten quality to it. And conversely, it's got a lot of other compounds in it that prohibit its use for making cookies or cakes. You wind up with grain that represents some calories that you can eat if you're starving, and you'd be grateful to have it, but it's not going to make anything that is particularly pleasing to the human palate, nor is it going to be pleasing to the bakers who can't get the stuff to process correctly going through a bake line.
Interesting, very interesting. So we put a lot of emphasis on quality. We've been sort of talking about quality here, but what is low-quality wheat? What is high-quality wheat? Are these real distinctions or just marketing ploys? And don't tell me it's in the eye of the beholder.
No, they're very real attributes. And when it comes down to it, high quality wheat is wheat that can be used economically to the benefit of the person who's in the end paying the bill, which is the consumer. And we do a lot of work in trying to elevate the quality of the grain that's produced through the wheat breeding process and to maintain high-quality wheat, because currently you ask people the difference between the wheat, say, coming out of Washington and the wheat coming out of the Black Sea area of Russia, and you know what high-quality versus low-quality wheat looks like. And this is why the Baltic Sea stuff, or not Baltic, but Black Sea stuff, is a mess. People only use it because it's cheap and it's close to some of the markets that are very price sensitive. People would as soon have more Washington wheat if they could afford to get it because it is high quality.
And but is this a function of genetics? Is this a function of where it's growing? What is this a function of?
A lot of it is genetics. And that incorporates agronomic genetics as well. If you can't grow it, you can't sell it. So you have to have quality in the field where you get a lot of yield and can actually produce it. And to do that at the lowest possible price of inputs. And then you get it to the other side, you've got to make a lot of flour out of it. But in the end, you've got to be able to make a product that people are willing to spend money to buy and to eat. And that's genetics. It's genetics, genetics, genetics. And if you have an area like we have here where you don't get much rain at harvest time, you don't have problems with pre-harvest sprouting issues, and the grain is sound, it's free of insects, it's free of dirt, and this makes it easy for people to process it, turn it into flour, turn it into products without adding a lot of extra stuff to it. And every time you have to add extra stuff, in either in terms of ingredients or in terms of cleaning it before you process it, that's money. And people need to make money, otherwise you go broke and what happens? But you have things coming out of the Black Sea that just doesn't function well at all. It mills poorly. You can't make products out of it. And so everybody, for example, in North Africa and the Middle East would love to have more soft white wheat or even hard white wheat from the Pacific Northwest because it performs, makes the products, and is very appealing to them. But trying to get it from here to there, the transportation cost of going across the Pacific or through the Panama Canal and across the Atlantic is greatly outweighed by the transportation costs that you get just coming through the Black Sea into the Mediterranean and dumping it off in Cairo, Egypt.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The Washington Grain Commission has been funding the Genotype and Environment Study, what we call the G&E study, since 1997 at least. Do you feel that the quality momentum we have engaged in the Northwest will carry the day, or do you worry about future variety releases?
The G by E study, Genetics by Environment study, is one of the best investments that anybody has ever made. It provides an excellent test bed for looking at varieties, enhancing their quality, and determining what is the environment doing to the quality of these individual varieties. It's incredibly valuable, both in terms of variety release and in as test beds for research. But I do worry a lot about future variety releases, not so much as they're involved with the public wheat breeding programs, but the private wheat breeders that are now starting to get into our market. They've been in the Eastern soft red market for years, but here in the Western area, it's been a lot of public breeding, and they've been doing a good job. But with the private breeders, they have no obligation to assure that their varieties that they're putting forth to release have any quality whatsoever. And so the only way that they would get quality is if the growers overcame a predisposition to get another 10 or 20 bushels per acre, but at the expense of the quality of the overall crop. And we've run into this issue a few times in the past, but I do worry considerably that economic pressures may skew what we have as high-quality grain in the Pacific Northwest in a downward fashion.
Yes, yes, we're all concerned about that. I was at a meeting where Hayden Wands, he's the vice president of procurement for Bimbo Bakeries, the largest bakery in the world, talked about increasing the speed of their bread lines to 170 loaves a minute. Now, that just takes my breath away. I doubt that I can deal cards that fast. What does that automation mean for wheat farmers?
That means that there's going to have to be more attention paid to varieties that can withstand that kind of automated processing, where everything works by the clock and not so much in an artisan sense where a baker will go out and look at the dough, touch it, feel it. Does it need more mixing? Does it need less mixing? It all becomes very automated. And you have to have varieties that have extreme ability and resilience to perform in a high-speed, highly mechanized plant like that. So there's going to be a demand for increased properties, especially in gluten performance going forward, that will accommodate this type of speed in a bakery plant. So varieties are going to start being selected and possibly even contract grown for their individual quality attributes and shipped off with these quality attributes to these very large high-speed bakeries because they will find value in it. So I see more contract growing in the future that'll absorb some of the varieties that have the quality characteristics that is needed.
So I went back and looked at some of my stories that I have written with you in the past, and you made a distinction to me once between calories and quality. Explain.
It's the quality issue again. You can grow lots and lots of wheat, and just like the Porgy and Bess song, you can have plenty of nothing. And for that, if you're a starving dude like our Neolithic ancestors were, you'll eat just about anything under the sun. So that would be calories, where you can just take wheat, grind it up, throw in a little water, toss it onto a hot brick, and there you go, pseudo bread, more like hardtack. But that would be calories. If you're starving, you want calories, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. However, then you get the higher quality, which starts producing products that are luscious and tasty and we like to eat. And as we've found out demographically, as countries move up from third world to second world to first world status, they start eating more and more wheat, but it has to be higher and higher quality. And just having low quality wheat like the Afghans had, or some of which comes out of the Black Sea, that's calories. You can eat it, you'll get calories, you'll survive, but it's not something that is really desirable to the human palate. You get wheat from Washington, the Pacific Northwest part of the U.S., you mill it, you bake it, it produces tasty, good textured products that we love to eat, and that's the fundamental difference. And the only way to get from calories to quality is through the application of a good, robust wheat breeding program and constant monitoring to make sure that the wheat is adhering to those standards.
So, Art, we've been working on developing our quality for more than 20 years now. Are we far enough ahead that we don't have to worry about countries like Russia coming up with higher quality wheat that is going, I mean, are we going to stay ahead of the curve, I guess, is my question.
Not without continued work and continued research. These lower quality countries realize that there's a huge quality gap in their wheat varieties. And parts of China, Russia, China more than Russia, understand that the quality has to be there in order for the grain to be economically utilized for the benefit of the people. And they are not sitting on their thumbs. They are pushing hard to develop higher quality wheat varieties. So we have a few years in here while they're still ramping up. It's that decade lag time. And if we take our eyes off the ball even for a little bit, we're going to get caught up to and passed. And so within that context, you can grow high quality varieties. And just like the strong and weak gluten types within soft white wheat, we have to be able to deliver that quality, which begs for participation by the marketing and wheat moving people to be able to provide reduced variation in cargo loads separated by end-use functionality instead of just the grosser FGIS grading standards. We have to be able to provide this to our clients, our customers, because if we don't, and if we don't establish a foothold in the market, they can easily move off to someone else, and then we're stuck with a lot of pretty good quality wheat that we can't do anything with domestically because all the industry is back east.
Yes. You indicated in reports that I've read from your trips overseas that millers appear to know how to treat their flour streams to make the best product, but they don't necessarily understand why. Does it make a difference that customers understand the milling wheat flour chemistry?
The customers downstream from the mills, maybe not so much, but there should be a little more sophistication in understanding what the flour's quality is beyond protein content and ash content, which is mostly how flour is sold to bakeries. We have to change the way we think about wheat from thinking of it as a bulk commodity and start thinking it as an active ingredient in bakery mixes. And if we start thinking about it as an ingredient instead of a bulk commodity, a lot of good things can happen. The mills themselves, especially in Asia, are beginning to understand that stream blending is very important and can certainly help with their economics, the amount of money they can sell flour for to the bakeries. And this is through the use of solvent retention capacity testing on the streams. Now, it's important to understand what the heck is a flour stream. Well, mills consist of a lot of different paired rolls that essentially purify and reduce the particle size of wheat. So you turn wheat into flour. That means you got to strip off the bran. You have the endosperm that is the starchy endosperm that is then reduced in particle size and becomes flour. Well, depending on which part of the wheat kernel you're talking about, they have very different end-use traits. And these traits can be somewhat identified through the use of solvent retention capacity testing, which is exposing the flour to different solvents and seeing how much of that solution is retained. And that reflects a lot about how that particular flour is going to perform in end uses. So in Asia, they're starting to analyze each one of these flour streams in a large mill, and there can be upwards of 120 different streams coming off of any particular large-scale mill. And so they do SRC analysis on each and every one of those streams and understand that, oh, okay, if we put these particular streams together, we're going to have a better product that will work better for cakes. We take some of the residual streams, put them together, that's going to be better for a cookie. And we take these streams over here, and that can be used for making crackers or even industrial uses. And so the Asians are starting to blend these things by functionality instead of just by gross, easily analyzed characteristics like moisture, protein, and ash. And so they're getting very sophisticated about treating wheat as an ingredient over there. And to that extent, they're a step up on the domestic wheat milling and utilization industry.
My experience of overseas buyers is that they don't want to pay a penny more than they have to. Are we going to see that changing?
No, nobody wants to pay more. But if something has manifest value and the customers overseas see that there is value, they will buy it regardless of premium costs of, you know, 50 cents a bushel even, they will buy it. It's just a matter of letting them know this is what's going on. And you don't see any Black Sea wheat going into Japan. They're very quality sensitive, but they're also very good bargainers. And they will bargain you down to the minimum cost that they will have to pay. But they will still go for the quality, all things said and done. And they won't go for second-rate quality.
Judging by conversations I've had with my boss, WGC CEO Glenn Squires, we're getting closer to the day customers will pay a premium for value if value means quality. But it will take the entire grain chain to make it happen, from people like Betke,
clear through to the export facility that loads the wheat on the boat, to the overseas staff that does the procurement. Old habits are hard to break, and doing things the same old way is less risky and sort of comforting. But if you listen to Betke closely, you heard a voice from the future speaking to you from the present, and it's saying, the day is coming when quality wheat will be considered an ingredient, and ingredients cost more. I hope you enjoyed episode 126 and will join me again next week for the second part of my conversation with Betke, when we'll open up that can of worms labeled 212 and 510 right here on Wheat All About It.
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.